panel talk session of today, followed by the demo, immediately afterwards by the demo session in an hour and a half. This is something of a radical departure in terms of recent SOSP practice. We've decided to somewhat unusually take the step of having a session which is devoted to operating system kernels. Some of you I know are old enough to remember what those things look like. And so our first talk is our third Best Paper Award winner of the conference. It's my great pleasure to introduce Kevin Klein and a cast of thousands to talk about formal verification of CELFOR. Kevin is not looking for a job, but he is looking for people who are looking for a job. So if this kind of thing appeals to you, and it certainly should, please talk to him at the demo session or some drinks afterwards. Anyway, thanks very much. Way to go, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. Well, it has been noted that there is a long list of authors here, so I'll introduce only some of them. On the top right, you have Bernard Weiser. He's the leader of the West group at NICTA and UNSW, and it was his vision and initial slightly crazy idea that we should embark on this endeavor. Then in the middle, top middle, we have Kevin Elphinstone. He is the leader of the SEL4 design group, and he has a nice background. On the top left, there's me. I'm the leader of the SEL4 verification group, and I have a theorem proving background. So if you have any deep OS questions at the end, I might defer them to the poster session and the demo, where Kev and Bernard will be able to answer. And then we have the cast of thousands. These are the researchers and engineers and students who actually did all the hard work, so the credit should be good to them. And the result of that work is this. So we'll talk about the fine print later. The idea is we took the SEL4 microkernel, it's about on the order of 10,000 lines of code, and we formally proved in the theorem prover, Isabel Hall, it's an interactive theorem prover, that it's functionally correct, that it has no bugs. The rest of the talk will be about why on earth would we do this, what precisely have we proved, how did we prove it, just a bit high-level effects on that, and then finally, how did the verification impact the design of this kernel? Okay, so why would we ever do this? Well, basically, we ought to be able to do better than that, right? And we definitely don't want to see that. So I don't mean to pick on a particular operating system that we all like. Instead, the idea is, well, we want to build highly trustworthy systems with high assurance. The corner we're from is, we want to build small kernels, and we have this architecture that you can see on the right. We want to use the small kernel to reduce the trusted computing base, to have a small number of trusted components next to a usually larger number of maybe really big components that you don't need. And the idea is that we want strong security and safety properties in the end. Well, so to make this work, to do any kind of verification of any technique on this kind of architecture, you need to make sure that the kernel works, right? If the kernel falls over in a heap, the whole system falls over. There's nothing you can do. And moreover, the maximum assurance that you can get about the whole system is limited by the assurance that you can get of the kernel. So this is really, if you want to get assurance about systems like this, you have to start at the kernel, and that's what we did. And we tried to get the most assurance that you can possibly get by formal verification. To give you a bit of an overview of what SEL4 is, SEL4, you could call a third generation microkernel. It's in the L4 family, so it has this idea of high performance, it has IPC threads, virtual memory, IQs. What's new in SEL4 in the L4 family is that it has capabilities for access control, so it's supposed to be a very flexible and strong security mechanism in the kernel, supported by the kernel. Okay, so this is why. Now what? So there are many properties you could prove about a kernel like this. So you could prove it never crashes. You could prove there are no null-pointed dereferences. Seems to be a little bit. You could prove that there are no buffer overflows, for instance. But we want more than that. We basically want the old dream of the 60s and 70s. We want to say, this is what the kernel is supposed to do. This is what correct behavior is. And here's the code. And it actually does that. So we want to prove functional correctness. That's what it's about. So in an OS, what would the specification look like? Basically, the idea is that the specification gives you the syscall API semantics. So for every system call, we say, this is the effect the system call has. For the purposes of the slides, I'm going a bit deeper, so I'm showing you an example of the scheduler here, because it's really nice and simple in the abstract specification. Basically, what you say there is, take any active thread in the system, pick, you know, take that whole set, it's a mathematical set, a simple concept, pick one of those elements and switch to that thread. Or, if that's not possible for some reason, because the set is empty, for instance, switch to the outer thread. That's, you know, very simple to understand, standard concepts for mathematics, no complicated data structures here. So it tells you what the kernel is supposed to do. The code, on the other hand, is big and messy, and that's really the only thing you should be able to read here. So there are all kinds of data structures in here, you know, scheduler actions, shortcut scheduling, priorities, and so on and so forth, and really tells the computer how to do this. But not yet. And the job of the proof is to show that this messiness correctly implements the specification. Okay, so that's the idea. I had this fine print on the first slide, and this slide tries to explain what the fine print is. So between specification and code, we basically live in the formal world, and the theorem proof as well in this case. And, well, you can worry about is the theorem proof correct or not, but basically there are techniques for this. You can crank up the assurance for this proof as high as you want. More interesting are the gaps on the bottom. How far is our understanding of what the code does to what really happens on silicon in the physical world? So what are the assumptions of the model? Also, there's another gap at the top. Are our expectations what, you know, what the spec says? Is this what the spec actually says? So do we read it right? Do we understand what we've written? So both of these gaps can be fairly large, or they can be fairly small. So there are techniques for making them fairly small. Our set of assumptions is the following. So we cut off at the level of C, which is way lower than other verification projects. So we have to trust, that means we have to trust the compiler and the linker. We have to trust the bits of assembly code that are still in the kernel. We have to trust that the hardware is correct. And we've left out in our model some occasion TLB management functions that are fairly low level, and we've left out the boot code. So we basically, we verify running operation. So if you want to invest more work, each of these assumptions can be worked on. So there is, for instance, a verified optimizing C compiler for the ARM architecture out there, which we haven't tried yet, but that's definitely one of the next steps we're going to do. There are groups out there that do assembly verification. I've seen Zhong Chao in the audience somewhere. I haven't spotted him now, but anyway, so his group has been doing assembly verification for some years, and it's actually future work for us as well to take that work and apply it to ASIA-4. And as you've heard, assuming that the hardware is correct is not something you can always do. But you can play all kinds of games in these models. So you can say, this is normal operation of the hardware. What if this happens instead? So for instance, nice example is the IOQ controller. What if I get spurious interrupts? And you can explicitly handle that in your model if you want. We haven't done that in this proof, but you could. Okay, enough about that. So if these assumptions are true, what do we have? We have this proof that the code always does what the specification says. But we also, additionally, get as a side product all these nice properties that you want anyway. So, for instance, we explicitly prove that there are no null-pointed dereferences. We also explicitly prove that there are no buffer overflows, no array indices that are polyfunctions. If you think about it, what it means that we always know what the code does. If the assumptions are true, then there's no code injection possible. Because otherwise the specification would have to say at some point, from here on, I don't care, do whatever you want. And we definitely don't say that in our specification. There's a whole list of properties, I won't go through all of them. Basically, it's all the C ailments that we have, they don't affect us. We prove that they don't. We also prove termination of each system call, so there is no infinite loop or no infinite recursion in this part. Also, there are some properties that are not implied by our proof. So for instance, non-functional properties. We prove functional correctness, so things like a covert channel analysis, which we have heard about in the last session, for instance, are not covered by this proof. You could attempt to do proofs about that, but that's just not what we think. Some of the press articles about this project claim we have proved, you know, the SEL4 kernel is always secure. You won't get my signature on that because secure doesn't have a definition as such for the kernel. We've certainly proved security properties. Some of these in the list here are security properties. But secure as such, well, doesn't mean anything. You first have to define it formally if you want to prove something about it. And also the statement is 0 bytes. You need to be slightly careful about that. We haven't proved that there are 0 bytes from expectation to physical world. So, especially if we have these assumptions, right? There could be bugs in the compiler or in the assembly code. Okay, but from scratch to code, we do have zero bugs. So that was what we proved. Now, how did we prove it? If you go back to this picture from spec to code, we've actually done this in two steps, so we have a design in between. We also extend the stack towards the top. So we additionally have a nice small security model of the kernel. In this case, it's an access control specification. It's very small. It's just 300 lines of code. Or Isabel specification, it has nice properties, so you can prove a nice little three-line theorem that says this model supports authority confinement, for instance. Hello, RM here means we haven't actually connected that fully yet to the specification. The point of the slide is that to show you, you don't have to stop at the specification. If you're interested in high-level properties, you can do that. You can put more, and you can put different specifications on top that focus, for instance, on just a particular aspect like security. Okay, to complete the picture, there's something slightly weird in the formal verification project. The design is not actually written in the Isabel theorem prover directly, manually. So all the rebits are in Isabel Hall. The design is actually automatically generated from a Haskell prototype. And the significance of this Haskell prototype is that this is really the interface between the US design team and the formal methods verification team. And I'll talk about that a bit more in the next section of the talk. Okay, just a quick run through. So you've seen the specification layer, so you know, small and simple concepts, mathematical concepts usually. The design already mentions algorithms, data structures, and gives you pretty much all of the how, just not the, you know, the dirty little performance tricks and bit encodings and so on and so forth. This is what the code does in the end. Okay, so this is just an overview of how the specifications look like. To get slightly more formal, this is the most formal it gets in the talk, so no formalism at all. What we have here is the model of the whole system that we have on each layer. And basically we have the user on the left, the idle and kernel thread and kernel mode on the right. The idle thread is the same in each layer. The user is also the same in each layer. The user is allowed to attempt anything it has the power to do. Basically, it can execute any instruction, it can mutate the state in any way. It can attempt to read and write to any memory location. If that read is authorized, then fine. If the read is, for instance, to an unmapped page, that will generate a VM fault, which is an event that causes kernel entry, and the kernel will deal with that. And when the kernel is done that, we go back into user mode. So the idea is that the user can really do anything it has the power to do. So it can be benign, it can be malicious, it can just be garbage if it wants. The idea is the kernel has to work. And the idea of the proof is that we, in each of these layers, we basically exchange the kernel component. So in the specification layer, we have a kernel that's, you know, talks about mathematical concepts and says just what is supposed to happen. In the design layer, we talk about algorithms and data structures. On the code layer, we really have the high performance implementation. And the idea is that the user is not supposed to be able to tell the difference. So any trace of the system that is possible at the code layer is already a trace of the system in the specification layer. That's really what the proof says. Okay, so this sounds far too simple, so I've tried to visualize the complexity of SEO form. So this is the call graph of the C version of SEO form. So each dot in the picture is a function, and an arrow between two dots means that one function calls the other function. As you can see, it's fairly big, it's messy. And, well, why is it messy? Well, why don't we have a nice design? Well, I've recently heard the definition of microkernel is concentrate all the messiness in an R scale, put it in the microkernel so that you can, you know, implement the rest of the system in a cleaner way. This is what happens. So by definition, this needs to be messy. Maybe. Okay. So far for how we deal with the verification. So what impact did this verification have on the kernel design? Well, okay, so in the beginning, we were actually afraid there would be, you know, quite a lot of tension between these two teams that we had. So when formal ethics practitioners and the kernel developers, we were afraid something like this might happen. So the keynote talk we had on Monday very strongly resonated with my formal methods soul. And while some of our OS guys are big fans of exterminate, Actually, if you dig a bit deeper, there's no real contradiction, and that's what we found. So there was, you know, there's some tension in how people see the world, but we actually were able to work together very productively. So where might this tension come from? Typical design process for a kernel, on the OS view at least, is you design the kernel, you have whiteboard discussions and so on, and you go off and implement prototypes and see, maybe even directly on hardware or in a simulator. But you iterate that process until you're happy, basically. The FMU is different. We don't want to deal with these implementations and hardware at all. We would sit down, you know, have the whiteboard discussion, pretty much the same discussion, but we would write formal designs and maybe do a more abstract formal specification, prove some things, iterate that process until we're happy. And maybe in the end, do an actual implementation. Okay, we needed to do both. And this is where the Haskell prototype comes in. We left to the OS people the capability to write prototypes. That was very important to them. And it was actually their idea that why don't we write them in Haskell? It's clean semantics, it can be translated into Haskell very, very easily. And that's what we did. One of the nice things there is that you can actually set the amount of detail that you want in the Haskell prototype. Very flexibly. So if you're interested in this specific feature and you want to implement this with pointers, you can. If you have this other feature that you've done 10,000 times before and you know how to implement it, you just use abstract Haskell lists, for instance. And you can do that within the same prototype. And the nice thing is we automatically get a formal design. We have M people, we can go away and do formal specifications on the site and already start proofs and give feedback to the design process in that manner. If we're relatively stable, we can start implementing the Z code. And this is not an automated translation. This is a manually written C code and it's hand optimized. But it's written by looking at the Haskell prototype at the design. Okay, so that's the idea. What design decisions did we make? Okay, so the main driver that verification gives you in the design process is you want to crank up the simplicity dot, basically. You want to reduce complexity. Because if it's hard to think about a feature, it's definitely going to be hard to prove that feature. There are three main drivers for complexity on this slide. First is hardware. Some of the things in hardware we just have to deal with. For instance, virtual memory is one of the main services of the kernel, so if there are page tables, we have to model what they are, what they do. And, okay, we just have to bite the bullet there. For other things, drivers are another major source of complexity in the kernel usually, but we just do the normal L4 microkernel thing. We move drivers outside the kernel. And we use different techniques, for instance, like driver synthesis, as you heard yesterday, to get quite drivers in user space. Okay, next major driver is concurrency for complexity. Well, I don't have to tell you, you know, concurrency is hard, especially in kernels. So the design decision we took here is we take an event-based kernel. We don't completely eliminate preemption in that kernel, but we limit preemption to a few well-chosen preemption points that are in long-running operations. And that makes the problem way easier for verification. We can, for the most part of the verification, pretend we have a sequential program, and at the preemption points, we explicitly deal with the concurrency type. Okay, final driver for complexity is just code complexity, and with that I mean all the evil tricks that you can do in C. C is a really ugly language for verification. And, well, okay, so one of the ways we think we managed to avoid some of that complexity is just that we started from this functional representation. We did the implementation in C by hand, manually, but we have this nice, clean, functional program in our head when we write it. So we avoid some of the messiness through that, I think. But some messiness remains, and the question for such verification projects is, you know, which subset of C, which subset of the implementation language can we support? And that's where this project made a number of contributions in the programming languages and verification area. Basically, we can treat everything from the C standard minus the things that are bad stuff. So we've heard also in the keynote talk, you know, Goto and so on, you should avoid that, and yes, we do avoid that. I think the most drastic restriction that we have is we don't allow references to the stack. You also heard yesterday this is bad style, and I totally agree. But sometimes you want to do that for performance. And we can work around that by allowing references to global variables. And yeah, that's what we do if you're, you know, too hungry for performance in this case. The reason why we don't allow this is basically It allows us to pretend that the stack lives in a separate universe from the rest of memory, and that allows us to do more automation in the replica chain. Okay, so, most frequently asked question for any replication project is, did you find any bugs? Yeah, we did. Some. So, a bit about the process. We didn't do a lot of testing on this kernel, because we did formal replication anyway. So we did this design process, we did our first de-implementation, we did some initial debugging and testing, and after that period, we gave the kernel, it would be a, you know, we'd call it an internal alpha release, it sort of works, but, you know. We gave that to a bunch of students, a bunch of student projects, that did all kinds of things, implement a small embedded OS on top of it, implement drivers on top of it. There's a project porting the kernel to the x86 architecture. And all these projects, in total, found 16 bugs in that kernel after initial debugging and testing. And apart from that, the kernel really appears to work fine. It just, you know, it usually works. During verification, we found 160 bugs, so 144 more, about an order of magnitude. So, okay, we didn't do a lot of testing, but I don't really want to speculate how much bugs are out there in the world. Also, I want to point out that we don't just do code verification. We also did a lot of design verification, right? This was a two-step process. We had two proofs between spec and design, and between design and code. So the design to spec proof was actually the more interesting one, because that was the proof that had the deep semantic concepts that told us this algorithm actually works, this algorithm terminates, this data structure has these properties, and so on and so forth. So in that part, we found about 150 issues in each of the layers, so design and the specification. So there are also proofs on the specification layer, invariants, internal consistency checks, and so on and so forth. I call them issues, not bugs, because you easily get into these discussions. Is this a bug or a feature? And especially in the spec, it's not always clear, and, you know, well, this is what feeds back into the design cycle, basically. Okay, so we found lots of bugs. What did we have to pay for it? If we slightly overestimate our salaries, in total, we had 25 person years, I would say, on this project, and if we take into account the salaries, we get, you know, let's say we spend $6 million. We spent actually a bit less, I think. So what do we compare this? So in the security space, for instance, there's this common criteria evaluation framework for software. It has 7 levels, from EL1 to EL7. 7 is the best. And the good thing about it, it has an industry rule of thumb. So for EL6, which is not the highest level, you have to pay about $10,000 per line of code. So for SEL4, this gives you in the order of 100 million. And we achieved way more assurance than this, and we spent 6 million. Okay. So we think it's cheap. To summarize, we have formal proof all the way from formal specification down to the C code. It's one of the largest proofs ever done in a theorem prover, so it's about 200,000 lines of handwritten proof script. It's machine checked. We found a lot of bugs. We have done verification not just on the code, but also on design and spec. And maybe a very high-level lesson to take away from this is if it's hard in the proof, it's already going to be hard in the implementation. If you have to think a lot of reason in your head about a feature in the implementation, then that's a good indicator that the proof will be hard as well. So to conclude, formal verification for this code size is worse, it's feasible, and it's cheaper than current methods that are out there. And I should note, it's fun too. It's not all hard, dreary work, you know. It's actually quite challenging, it's creative, and it's very addictive. So almost all of the OS designers ended up doing formal proofs in the end. And yeah, so what they already mentioned, we're hard. Thanks.
George Candetti, EFL. I really love this work, and unlike tradition, I'm not going to ask a mean question after saying that. I wonder if you can comment a little bit on what happens when you have to evolve the code. What are the steps you have to go through, and kind of what's the effort associated with that?
Yeah, thanks very much for that question. I was actually planning to do a slide on that, but I didn't in the end. So what happens if you want to change and evolve the code? Basically, the answer is it depends. So if it's just an optimization on the code level that doesn't change the semantics but just makes it faster, That's very easy. You invest maybe, depends on the size of the change, but you invest a few days in reproving that. If you add a new feature to the kernel that is, that doesn't break its system concepts, but just adds new ones, we had that. We have a whole section in the paper about what happens with change. That basically depends on that new feature. It doesn't depend so much on the rest of the kernel, unless you start screwing around in existing data structures, because you have to prove that all the old invariants are preserved. If you add a new feature that does that, if you break existing invariants, then you are for more work, because you have to re-verify that the old components of the kernel are still working together with the new feature. And finally, if you completely change the model, well, then you are for re-verification of everything. But the good thing is, the theorem prover will tell you, right? You do a change, you run the theorem prover, and it says, okay, here it breaks, you have to do something. Whereas if you normally do a change, it might work, and you will not ever see any problem until it actually hits your production.
Okay. Kemper, I have a question. So, first of all, I also think this is awesome. We do a lot of work on this type of verification, and I'll talk to you more. I'm a believer in it. And nonetheless, I want to question whether your work solves the state problem. Because the Boeing safe bus or the Airbus equivalent, these have many computers in them. Realistically, those assumptions you made are significant assumptions. And so at the end of the day, you've got a very sophisticated test check of the kernel, but the system, it was any more confident, inspiring than it was before you checked it.
Okay. So if I understand the question right, then you're basically saying the assumptions are too big and it's not solving the whole problem. There's more out there in the world.
No, actually, the question is whether it's possible to solve the original state of the problem. The picture of the same bus the air bus that pointed our confidence, and I don't see why this isn't confidence.
Okay, so first of all, this is just the first step, right? So as I explained before, you can reduce the assumptions if you want. Also, there's a lot more research to be done. Now, I have a verified kernel, what do I do with it? This is actually our next big project. So, getting architectures that work with the features of SEL4 and getting formal proofs that interact with the proof that we've done so far. Of course, this is not the only technique that you should use. So if you are actually going to deploy a system like this in an Airbus, for instance, you want to use this in conjunction with testing and validation, because you need to test that your understanding of the specification, for instance, is what you want the plane to do. So it's one component of a bigger picture, but I think what it does, basically, is it takes the 8,000 lines of C out of the picture, and it allows you to reduce your efforts on the gaps that are left.
But isn't that, I'm not stopping this, but isn't that bigger picture probabilistic, inherently for components that are broken, and therefore not behaving the way they should have been verification?
I'm not sure we're going to get a clear answer to that question. So that's an excellent part of the conversation later.
Short time from University of UA. So I think it's very easy to understand that you can verify something like there's no null point of difference, there's no divided by zero. But how can you verify something like a high level of assurance such as the address spaces for two processes are isolated? So how can you express an environment like this? And if you can, and it's something like you need to expose all the execution paths and it's like you work here like forever to perfect.
Okay, so if I understand the question right, you're asking what does this tell me about the user space, basically? Can I use this to prove that, for instance, two address spaces are isolated? And do I need to go down to the bottom level again if I want to do that? Is that right?
Okay.
So, yes, you can do that. you still have to do some work. You still have to do proof. For instance, there's no problem using SEL4 in a stupid way. You can still do that. What the proof gives you is you can use, for instance, the security model that we have to say, I give to this process only capabilities for this part of the address space, and I give to this other process only the capabilities for this part of the address space. And the confinement theorem will tell you that it's not possible that capabilities travel in either way, and you have an additional property in the kernel that capabilities completely determine who has access to what. So you can actually use this on the specification level to prove that, for instance, two address spaces are isolated and stay isolated. So you don't have to go down to the code, but you have to go to the level of specification, and you do have to do some proof.
I might have a couple of quick questions.
Yeah, Matthew Nix, University of Illinois. You made the statement hard in implementation, hard in specification. They had about the same number of bugs. Did you see a correlation between the logical errors of guessing made in specification and implementation?
Not really, because the C implementation was started after the design proof was almost complete. So we had already found most of the design bugs when we did that. So actually, the C bugs that we found are fairly, I don't want to call them stupid, but you know, they're typos, they're copy and paste errors, they're, you know, things that happen easily when you just sit down and hack code. And they don't turn up easily in testing necessarily. So there were very few deep bugs in that part of the group, because the deep part was already done.
Good, big
work. Good, Cornell University. It's very nice work, but looking at the types of things that you proved and thinking about the types of things that I would like to have proved about my OS, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect. Typically, the types of things I'd like to reason about are temporal things. Eventually, something will happen. A is always followed by B at such and such a time. And these kinds of things, are they expressible in your language? And how do you foresee actually happening?
So, they're certainly expressible in high order logic. It might not be the nicest way to express that. But these, as you said, they're temporal properties, they're not functional properties. You would need the functional correctness proof to show the temporal properties. And actually, this is exactly what you said. You want, these are properties on the operating system. They're not necessarily properties of the microkernel, because what happens in the microkernel is not usually eventually, it's immediately, and you know that. So in that sense, we've proved some temporal properties, but it's a bit of a cop-out. So really, the algorithms on top of that, they should use the temporal.
Okay, well, thanks very much again.